Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components Live. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
Glad you're catching our live show after it was live and is now a podcast. If you want to join the live show, we stream every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on LinkedIn and YouTube, but you can always find the recording on your favorite podcast app. All right, let's get into it. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Components Live. You may have noticed that one of the three members that is typically on this call is actually here. And we also have Casey as a special guest again, which you're a special guest, but really you should just be like a constant special guest, I think. Ren and Patrick are both out, so the adults are gone. So now the kids get to play and have a good time in here. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so we have two main things to talk about. Casey and I each brought something. Casey's going to talk about middle school, I think. For something, I don't know. I'm going to let you explain it because I don't know.
High school,
is it middle? It was ninth grade.
Yeah, at least where okay. I'm from.
All right. Well, just, hey, listen. I grew up in middle of the country. Sometimes ninth grade is middle school.
It all blends together. It's all one school.
It's all one school. K through 12, same room.
Yeah. So I read an article earlier this week and it was titled What Ninth Grade Biology Has to Do with B2B Content Optimization. And this article was mainly focused on marketing content, but the correlation that the writer made was that it's all about experimentation and the scientific method. And for someone with a physics background, you know, I use the scientific method all the time. I love the scientific method. Big fan of it. And so I was really interested in that. And then it got me thinking kind of, you know, what about content operations and how we personalize content and experiment with personalization? And I think a lot of companies are starting to feel that like some of the best marketing that they have is happy customers. Yeah. And happy customers, you know, they get great customer service. They get, better than expected time to results, and they get kind of fast and hassle-free answers. And a lot of that relies on having like good personalization and personalization with a plan. So it got me kind of thinking, like, we have a lot of customers that personalize content, but I've never asked them why they made the specific choices on how to personalize and what to personalize. And you're much closer, I think, because
I have a lot of those conversations.
Yeah. And so I thought that would be interesting to kind of talk about, because I'm on the other end of that where someone is saying, hey, we want to do this thing and it's important to us for this reason. And we're like, yeah, we can do that. And this is how you would do it. But then the whole background process of how the customer got there, I feel like it's something I haven't explored enough. And I'm also hoping that our audience, if they've gone through that process, could leave some comments and say, you know, how did they approach it? Did they experiment with different audiences, or was it just, you know, very clear to them who their audiences were?
Yeah, you know, there, I'm thinking of one customer in particular that we have that I've, they kind of like grew through our organization as I migrated roles like a couple of times actually. So it's funny that like my change of position within our company, like kind of matched what they were doing. And so I got to like follow them through the like early on in the sales stage. And then we were doing implementation stuff. They were getting content set up and breaking it apart, tagging it for personalization. And then like now I'm at a different place where I still go back and talk to them when they want to like talk about changes and how those changes might affect like how they operate in the system. So I've gotten to like ride along. And what's interesting is they started off with a lot of possible audiences for personalization. Like, I think for any given page that you might see on their help site, there were something like the average page had like 30 some variations that page could be presented in depending on the audience. And they broke things down by, they have a complex product offering And some of the product pieces are so modular that they just like the leadership team could say like, you know what, we're going to make that piece part of this product over here now. And they could, in principle, just remarket and rebrand that product as having this other thing, because their entire product suite is so modular that they could then move these pieces and say like, well, it's now a part of that product. And so if you have this product group, you get that feature. What we found out is this particular customer had the opportunity to tag content for more than that 30 some audiences. It could have been hundreds if they wanted to, because they could have tagged everything by like feature and product group and customer type and role and all of that. But what they found was the cognitive effort it took to write and manage for all of those like hundreds of audiences was just too much. And so they had to find a sweet spot, and somewhere in the range of like 30 to 40 is that sweet spot for them for delivering content and being able to write it and manage it.
Well, I mean, 30 to 40 is incredible in itself. I think, you know, most companies, one or two audiences is a challenge by itself, right? So that's pretty incredible to manage that many different audiences. So that's interesting. So do you know when they went through that process, that what kind of metrics they were using to determine like what was important, or was that kind of, were you too far away from that?
What do you mean by like determining what was important for them? Like, do you mean content sets as a particular persona or something?
Yeah. So different personas, obviously, like if they had a choice between 30 and 100 different levers that they could pull, you know, I'm assuming that that correlates to quite a different number of personas that might be using different parts of the software or different configurations of the software. So it's really interesting to kind of understand what's the process for determining what's the most important ones to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that their initial goal, the driving force, was personalization, just like full stop. We want to make sure that when a customer comes to the site, they only see the content for the products that their organization has purchased for their particular role as the user. So we might be able to purchase a single product from them that would have a bunch of different features. And then you might have like an admin role in that product. I might have like an attendee role or something, like just basically a user role, but not admin. And then there are some other ranges in there. And then effectively so they started off with this goal, only show content to the individual user for the products that their organization has purchased and for their particular role within that organization. And what they found is that was still too many audiences, given the number of types of users you could have in their system, the number of different product combinations you could put together. It still was too much from a content creation and management standpoint, just from a team perspective. Like, there isn't a technical limitation.
Like hands on keyboard. Yeah.
Yeah. Hands on keyboards. It was like overwhelming for the amount. So then they started to have to do, I mean, maybe this is where you think like scientific method comes in. They started categorizing and basically looking at what is the breakdown. I'm trying to avoid some of these like catchy words in our space, but from, you know, the philosophy classroom or from the biology classroom, they make sense. Like, they started basically looking at their product ontology and the structure of it, and then going, all right, given all of this, now how should we personalize this? Understanding that we humans have a limitation to our ability to just simply write content that is aimed at 100 different users in a single file or something. So,
yeah, that makes perfect sense, right? So like the user personas of the product that's being utilized kind of governs the major audiences that you are published to. I think where it gets really interesting is when you kind of think about the level of detail in the content or the expertise, and like those can be audiences that they're like a super group of multiple different personas, particularly in the software. And I don't think many companies get to that point where they're actually doing that type of exercise, but I think it'd be really, really interesting, especially with some of the newer tools and ways that people can generate content. It might be easier to do that and test that now than it was, say, 3 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Well, maybe we'll save save the question for the next one, but like it talks about, like, it hints at anyway, like what, how should we understand what a content operate, what content operations are for an organization? So I want to bring up one thing, and I don't mean to open up, this is a separate can of worms, and I don't really mean to open it up as like, let's get ultra controversial here. But I found this, article. It was linked to on LinkedIn. I don't even remember where on LinkedIn I found it, but I have like the actual article. It's very short. It's
more like a real article. You didn't make it up, right?
I didn't make it up. Like, I'm staring at it and I didn't write it. So it's, the title is, the equivocation in the title I have a hard time with as someone who likes to be clear about things, but the title is called Ditto Without Ditto, which is, it's an equivocation. A more accurate title is, how do we get the benefits of Ditto without Ditto? Like, that's what the title really is. And so the assumption is, we're using a DOCSIS code pipeline. And then, are there ways that we can get the things that are valuable about Ditto out of a non-Ditto framework? And it calls out three things. Like, Ditto's function, really, it's one of its driving goals, or its three main driving goals are enforcing a structure. Yeah, it does that. Reusing content at all kinds of levels and generating personalized content, basically like tagging things. So this very, very brief write-up is like, can you get this without using Ditto? And can you do this in a DOCSIS code framework? And the answer is like, it's yes. Like, you can do this. There are ways to do it. That's not really what I want to focus on. What I want to focus on is this one line right at the end. It's a conditional. If strict enforcement of a structure is not a requirement, Ditto is not needed. Like, okay. But at what point, when you're creating documentation about your product, do you not want enforcement? And like, what's interesting is literally there's a button at the bottom of this article that says next for like the next article. And it's from DOCSIS code to Ditto. And it's a really great article too. And it's like, when should you consider making the move from DOCSIS code to Ditto? And I don't have anything against DOCSIS code, just generally speaking. But there, the next one is like, here's a thing that tech writers really want, consistency. And it's like, if consistency is really, really important to you, then you should consider adopting Ditto, just generally speaking, because it forces the consistency with the structure. And I'm just like, when do you not want consistency? When are you like, yeah, it doesn't matter? Like, I don't think anybody ever really thinks that. And so I think the idea of like, we don't want consistency is, or we don't care, I don't think anybody really has that. So maybe the question is like, is it about strict enforcement of a structure or consistency? And maybe that's where there's some flexibility. But this is one thing that I always wonder about. Like, I work with people all the time that are like, we're working in Word and Google Docs. That's less consistent than even Markdown. And you can do whatever you want in there. Like, it's the Wild West in Word still. And even those people are like, well, we have these templates in Word so that our writers know what to put where and that we get the same structure every time. Like, even people who are in unstructured environments are still trying to get structure. Yeah, they're trying to get the structure out of it. So I just don't know. I mean, I think the main motivation for a company to adopt something like DOCSIS code is like, if you're devs, and you could speak to this because you're a developer, if your developers are going to be doing a lot of contribution and like source contribution to your documentation, I can see how that there can be cases for it then. If you have a dedicated writing team, I'm less inclined to think DOCSIS code is the right way to go, generally speaking.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing that makes it really attractive is that it would, to teams that are heavy in development, is that they already have the expertise to use a lot of the tool chain. Which is a double-edged sword, though, because it means you can get into it and produce and publish something really quickly.
Super fast.
But then almost every organization is creating their own way of doing everything after that. And yep. So there's very little standardization. I mean, there's some projects to help with that. But it's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Ditto is a standard and a philosophy. And it does, nothing says you have to use XML. I think that's like maybe one of the intentions is like what format you're using.
Yeah.
You know, nothing says you have to use XML to implement DITA. Like, you know, it has a vocabulary that has a specific structure that should be enforced that's based on best practices. So you certainly could do that in almost any system that could represent that vocabulary, you know, sufficiently well and validate it. I think the challenge is that there's been, you know, DITA has become extremely mature. So there's been 20 years of work done to work out all of the tooling and the processes and things like that. And there's even in, you know, in any technology, a lot of rework has to happen to basically reinvent all those wheels. So if you're really looking at getting the same level of benefits, it's hard to say that you should reinvent all of those wheels unless there's like one really specific thing you want. Like we just want reuse. Then there's ways you can inject that into almost any format.
You got a little thumbs up there. What was that about?
Where's the thumbs up?
Do you see that? You got a thumbs up pop up next to your head. That was great.
Hopefully that was from someone actually watching this.
I'm pretty sure that was your computer, but either way, I'm very excited. I think we need to continue like the comparison of like DOCSIS code, its pros and cons, and DITA pros and cons. Like, I mean, I don't know, maybe we do a running series about that, but I think it's something worth talking about because there's a time and a place for sure for either one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, that's it, Casey. We have hit 16 minutes, which it's supposed to be a 15-minute show, and 16 is our standard. So we're right on time.
No hot takes or whatever we call
it. I don't have hot takes ever.
My only hot take is if you're in the path of totality for the eclipse coming up, it's on April 8th. Don't miss it.
That's right.
It's going to be like 120 years before the next one's really visible anywhere you can get to easily in the United States.
Also, so I will, you leave with that, which reminds me of this. I'll leave with this. If you ever drop your keys into a river of molten lava, forget them, because man, they're gone.
They're gone. That's it.
See ya. Have a good weekend, man.
From experience?
Nope.
Okay.
It's a Jack Handy quote.
Just in case.
Yeah. See you, buddy.
All right. Good weekend, everyone. Bye.
Bye.